You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the James Webb Space Telescope took photographs of what looked like galaxies that, under current scientific theory, shouldn't exactly exist. An astrophysicist shares those findings with us. Now, Wisconsin undergraduates in the UW system may see their first tuition increase since state lawmakers froze tuition for in-state undergrads more than a decade ago. Last week, UW System President Jay Rothman told the State Assembly's Colleges and Universities Committee that he will be asking the Board of Regents to approve a 5% increase for the next academic year.
It is essential that we seek this increase for the long-term financial viability of our universities and to sustain the quality of education, research, and services that we provide.
Just yesterday, Governor Evers said he would prefer the UW system get more money coming from the state as opposed to Wisconsin students and parents. His budget proposal would add more than $300 million to the UW system. Rich Kramer covers higher education for Wisconsin Public Radio. He joins us now with the latest. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to be back, Rob.
Can you take us back to the start of Wisconsin's in-state tuition freeze? When did it begin and why has it stuck around?
This goes way back to the 2013-2015 budget, and the freeze came after Republican lawmakers became very angry and accused the UW system of raising tuition exponentially over a series of years while holding on to more than around $600 million in cash reserves from unspent tuition. The UW system said at the time that those reserves were not just laying around, it was dedicated to various things. But because of the anger over that, and because the Republicans held, you know, the assembly, the Senate, and the governor's seat, it led to a tuition freeze that continued, until 2021.
How did the UW Board of Regents regain the authority to set tuition rates for the UW system, especially when it comes to in-state undergraduates?
That was included in the state budget, the 2021-2023, the current state budget. And the authority, so former UW system president Tommy Thompson essentially said that he had to negotiate with lawmakers about finding the right balance between, you know, a request for additional money from the state and the authority to get the tuition freeze lifted. And Republican lawmakers at the time said that, you know, it's been a long time. This authority should go back to the regents, but they also warned Thompson that, you know, if you include tuition increases in your UW system budget request, it won't go anywhere. So he said that kind of casually from the hip during a forum, and it really caught my attention. So they've also, since they've regained that authority, they haven't recommended a freeze since. Like, this is the first time that the regents and UW system president seem poised to actually go forward with that.
And what does UW system president Jay Rothman say in support of this idea of boosting the tuition after so many years?
Well, he says that UW system, you know, tuition is already more affordable than most other states, or I think he said all other states in the Midwest. And he said that'll continue to be the case even after this 5% increase. So he says affordability won't be a factor. And as he mentioned in the cut that you played, they just have been, you know, asking for more revenue. They haven't gotten a lot of additional revenue from any one state budget. So they're looking at this as an option. And I should back up a little bit, because in addition to the tuition freeze, there was a $250 million cut in that state budget during the Walker administration. And that led to a lot of cuts that, you know, they had early retirement incentives. So a lot of faculty left the UW system, and some UW faculty members have said quality of education could be or is being affected as a result of that. So this is an attempt to try to get back some additional revenue.
Talking to WPR higher education reporter Rich Kramer about a proposal from the UW system president to boost tuition for in-state undergrads after a long tuition freeze. Want to check out some action from the governor and in the legislature, Rich. Now, a proposal by a state representative looking to peg tuition increases or limit, I guess, tuition increases to inflation. What are we seeing there?
That bill came from, well, there's more lawmakers involved with it, but the main driver behind it is Republican Assemblyman Dave Murphy. He chairs the Assembly's Colleges and Universities Committee. He's circulated that bill for co-sponsors, and the memo attached to it essentially said, you know, the legislature needs to have some sort of a limit on there because they didn't want to see big increases like they had in past years. This isn't the first time there was a tuition freeze. There was individual years where freezes had taken place, and then afterwards tuition rose quickly afterward. And he didn't want to see that happen again, but he was surprised when Jay Rothman mentioned this 5% increase during a committee hearing that he was chairing. Murphy said he didn't realize that 5% was under the current rate of inflation, which was 6.4% this spring.
And then Governor Evers, as I mentioned, included a boost in funding for the UW system. What is he calling for? What's the case he's making?
The governor is recommending, well, there's two parts to it. So there's the operating budget, and then there is the capital budget. But for the operating budget, which pays for, you know, instructional activities, he is recommending an additional $305 million for the UW system. That is a big increase. And he said that because of that, at the time, he said that tuition shouldn't have to be raised with that additional revenue. The trick is, though, that what the governor proposes for a budget is definitely not what winds up in the final budget once the Republican-controlled legislature gets done with it. So in the past, he's recommended what they call funding the freeze. So while the freeze was still in effect, the governor had recommended in past budgets big increases to kind of backfill the lost revenue from that, or the projections of lost revenue. And that did those sorts of funding the freeze things were pulled from the budget by Republicans in past years. So that could be also why the UW system is looking to kind of take matters into their own hands again. But I would assume that the tuition increase proposal and this additional money the governor is recommending could raise some eyebrows.
It's a long and winding road to a final budget, Rich. Have Republicans in the legislature given any indication on what they think of the governor's proposal this time around for a boost to the UW system?
Well, with regard to the UW system, I haven't seen any statements, but Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, Republican from Rochester, essentially said of the budget in its entirety that it's devoid from reality. So that kind of gives you a taste of what they think about it.
And briefly, Rich, what's the next step for this tuition increase proposal to the Board of Regents?
Well, it sounds like the UW Board of Regents are going to consider it and potentially approve it at their meeting later this month. That meeting is going to be happening at UW Stout, right in my neck of the woods in Menominee. So it still could be voted down by the board, but generally things that are recommended by the UW system president pass the board. So we'll see.
Rich, thanks for bringing us up to date.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
That's Rich Kramer. He covers higher education for WPR. Judges for look at proposals for funding the UW system and the possibility of the first in-state tuition increase for in-state undergrads in over a decade. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story of a historic part of Milwaukee.
There's a peninsula just off Lake Michigan in Milwaukee that has lived many lives. Today, Jones Island is home to a sewage treatment plant, piles of salt, and rail cars. But it was once home to thriving communities.
Indian, French-Canadian, Yankee, and Polish, each utterly erased by the one that followed before today's landscape emerged. Few places in Wisconsin have seen such profound change, and fewer still have so many tales to tell.
Jones Island is the subject of a new Milwaukee PBS documentary by author and historian John Gerda. In People of the Port, a Jones Island documentary, Gerda talks about the Potawatomi who lived there and used the area to fish, gather wild rice, and race ponies. After the Potawatomi were displaced, European immigrants began settling down on Jones Island. As Gerda tells us, A Polish immigrant community flocked to the area, drawn in for the same reasons as Jones Island's earliest settlers, which was fishing.
It's not a tourist attraction. Jones Island lies just blocks from downtown Milwaukee, but visitors are few. What they see is freight yards, fuel tanks, docks, the Danhone Freeway Bridge, and the largest sewage treatment plant in Wisconsin. Here was the city's front door in the age of sail, and here is the hub of its urban infrastructure today. What it lacks in glamour, Jones Island makes up for in stories. For nearly 50 years, from the 1870s to the 1920s, the peninsula was the site of a commercial fishing village settled by immigrants from the Baltic Sea coast of Poland. These Kashubes, as they were called, numbered more than 1,500 by the turn of the 20th century. First in rowboats near the shore, then in motorized tugs that chugged over the horizon, they brought up 2 million pounds of fish in a typical year, including lake trout, whitefish, herring, perch, and sturgeon. Their catch was a critical source of protein for Milwaukee's growing population. Fishing also provided a livelihood for one of the most unusual urban villages in America. Jones Island was a colony of squatters who occupied their land without benefit of title. Their homes were makeshift, their street system was improvised, and their shoreline was a maze of fish sheds, boathouses, and massive wooden net drying reels. The setting was so picturesque that artists from the mainland were among the most frequent visitors. What they found was a complete human community. Jones Island was a complex web of interrelated families who supported social clubs, a baseball team, a chorus, and a total of 11 saloons, each serving its own version of the Friday night fish fry. The Kashubes were also faithful members of St. Stanislaus Catholic Church. Whole families could be seen every Sunday morning, rowing across the Kinnickinnick River in their finest clothes to Mass on Mitchell Street. Jones Island may have been picturesque, but its days were numbered. As mainland Milwaukeeans enjoyed electricity, running water, and indoor plumbing, the Kashubes were still getting by with kerosene lamps, contaminated wells, and backyard privies. By 1910, as the city's population surged toward 400,000, there was an urgent need for two major improvements, a sewage treatment plant and an outer harbor. Jones Island was the obvious location for both. In 1914, the city condemned the fishing colony. Family by family, its residents moved to the mainland. In less than a decade, the number of dwellings plunged from more than 200 to just 6. Most of the holdouts lived on the riverside of the peninsula. Their unofficial mayor was Felix Struck, a one-time fishing tug captain who had come ashore to run a weather-beaten saloon called the Old Harbor. His time was finally up in 1943, near the midpoint of World War II, when Struck was evicted for reasons of what authorities called port security. The old fisherman moved to a new home on the south side. 5 months later, he was dead. In a moment of inspired whimsy, the city turned the site of Captain Struck's last stand into a park and named it for the island's dominant ethnic group. Kashubes Park is the smallest in Milwaukee, about the size of a basketball court, but it occupies a unique place in the city. In the midst of today's manufactured landscape, the park is the last reminder that Jones Island was once a living, breathing human community.
John Gerda is an author and historian who lives in Milwaukee. He also co-created a new Milwaukee PBS documentary, People of the Port, a Jones Island documentary. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we talk to a scientist whose research could change the way we think about the early development of the universe. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The James Webb Space Telescope, which launched in December of 2021, captured some images that could shake up what we know about the earlier days of the universe. They appear to show galaxies that, at least based on some current theories, probably shouldn't exist. One of the authors of that research joins us now to help us understand what's going on. Erica Nelson is an assistant professor of astrophysics at the University of Colorado Boulder. Erica, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm from Minnesota, so this is very exciting.
One of our old neighbors. Good to have you back. Well, this Webb telescope, it's capturing a lot of images that, you know, of things we haven't seen before. Can you walk us through what you spotted here and why it stood out as something weird?
Yeah, it's so, I mean, this was definitely the most exciting discovery of my scientific career. The data were first released over the summer by Joe Biden in this big press conference. And then, you know, shortly after that, we got access to all the, you know, the data behind those beautiful images. And I immediately started looking for things that were in the James Webb image that weren't in the previous Hubble image. And my eyes were immediately drawn to these objects that were red and bright and didn't exist in James Webb. And it turns out when my colleague Rachel and I fit them, one of them was this remarkably massive, remarkably early galaxy. And we knew immediately that it shouldn't be there.
Why shouldn't it be there?
Well, you know, the universe, we think, began with the Big Bang 14 billion years ago. And then after that, everything that we know had to assemble. And we think that things started assembling with first the littlest things like atoms, and then gradually building stars, and then eventually building little galaxies and then bigger galaxies. And so you shouldn't have really big galaxies for a really long time, because they are supposed to take a long time to grow. And so these things just shouldn't be there according to our current understanding of how the universe works.
How sure are we that these are in fact big galaxies that we're looking at?
We always need confirmation. So we're, yeah, you heard that, Hedge. So we are hoping to get additional data from James Webb that will definitively confirm or refute the nature of these objects. And so then we'll be able to say for sure. But the thing is if even one of these six objects turns out to be what we think it is, it's still a really big problem for our models of the early universe.
Yeah, what do we have to do then and revise to understand these if they are, as you say, big early galaxies?
Well, there's some people who would say that we need to change our cosmological theory, which, you know, really underlies everything we think we know about the universe that we live in, our origins, our fate, how all of the stars with all of the planets and the universe formed, how, you know, everything. So, you know, that's possible. It's also possible that, you know, our understanding of how dark matter aggregates in the early universe could be wrong. Our understanding of how stars form in the early universe could be wrong. There's a whole host of possibilities if these things end up being right.
Now, one of the mind-blowing things for me as a lay person is when we're capturing images of galaxies really far away from us, because, you know, the light from them is poking along at the, you know, the speed of light, it also means we're looking into the past, like the very distant past. And I still have trouble wrapping my brain around that. Can you help me through that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I've never heard someone describe light as poking along, but I love that. That's great. I mean, in a cosmic sense, it is. So light, as you said, pokes along. It takes time to travel. So, you know, the light from our sun, which is our nearest star, that light actually takes 8 minutes to travel from the sun to us. So, you know, if the sun all of a sudden turned into a black hole, we wouldn't know for 8 minutes because we're still seeing the light, seeing the sun as it was 8 minutes ago. And so if you can take that concept and then apply it to the universe as a whole. And so things that are really far away, like these really distant galaxies, it takes 13.5 billion years for that light to travel to us. So we're really looking back to the beginning of the universe, which is just a mind-blowing concept.
Now, one other possibility here I've seen, I think you were talking about this in an interview I saw. If these aren't galaxies, they could be something different, like quasars? What's that?
Yeah. One of these, actually, we know is a quasar. It's a baby quasar. It's a cute little quasar. And so this is weird, right? So what a quasar is a quasar is a supermassive black hole that is eating its lunch. And so you don't think of black holes as being bright, right? Like they're black holes. They're literally called black holes. But it turns out that when they're eating, they're actually some of the brightest objects in the universe.
So what does it mean if we're seeing these big quasars from then instead of big galaxies from then, I guess?
Yeah, so it turns out that, you know, another mystery in our understanding of the universe actually is how you form supermassive black holes. So we think that there is a supermassive black hole, like, you know, a billion times the mass of our sun at, you know, in the center of most galaxies. And so, well, a million to a billion solar masses. But and so we think that every galaxy harbors one of these really huge black holes, and how you actually make those black holes, we don't really understand, because it also doesn't seem like there's enough time in the history of the universe to form objects like that. So it would also be really exciting if a bunch of these ended up being baby quasars. We don't think that's the case for other reasons, but even having the one baby quasar is very exciting.
In our just last half a minute or so, years ago, I remember an astronomer told me you can divide astronomy into pre-Hubble telescope and post-Hubble. Is it the same kind of thing with this Webb telescope, the sort of things we're seeing?
I think it will be. Yeah, I mean, we're only 6 months into this telescope, and already there's been just absolutely groundbreaking discoveries. And I think the pace of discoveries is only going to accelerate as we have time to actually look at these data. And the nice thing is this thing's going to be up for 20 years. So there's so much time for people to contribute and make their own discoveries.
Erica, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Erica Nelson, assistant professor of astrophysics at the University of Colorado Boulder, formerly, as we heard, of Minnesota. She talked to us about her research on what appear to be massive galaxies recently photographed by the James Webb Telescope and why they may change our understanding of the development of the universe in its earlier days. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, President Biden and congressional Republicans are offering their plans for future funding of Medicare. We'll find out what they have on the table and what it can mean for the future of healthcare in the United States and how we pay for it. And what are the big names of the new year? An expert on baby names joins the show for a look at some of the latest trends, and you could share your own naming decisions, maybe your difficulties, the story behind your own name. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then an expert on the international drug trade joins us to examine the flow of fentanyl in the United States and what might be able to slow it down. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, outdoor adventurer Emily Ford shares her winter expeditions on the Ice Age Trail and across the Boundary Waters. First, Republican Senators Lindsey Graham and John Kennedy introduced new legislation today to designate 9 Mexican drug trafficking groups as terrorist organizations. Graham said the bill would set the stage for the U.S. to use military force if necessary. The push comes in response to growing concerns over fentanyl and other drugs flowing into the country from Mexico and a recent kidnapping of 4 U.S. citizens in Mexico that left 2 dead. The latest proposal to combat the dangerous opioid problem that spanned multiple administrations with no clear end in sight. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the flow of fentanyl and other drugs in the United States? Is there a solution you'd like to see us try? Has fentanyl been a problem in your life, with your family, in your community? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Vonda Felbob-Brown is a senior fellow in the Strobe Talbot Center for Security, Strategy, and Technology in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. She's their director of the Initiative on Non-State Armed Actors, co-director of their Africa Security Initiative. Vonda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Let's first of all talk about the role of fentanyl as part of the drug mix in the United States. We've talked a lot on the show about fentanyl in Wisconsin. Nationwide, how big a part of the problem are fentanyl and other synthetic opioids?
Synthetic opioids are generating the most significant and devastating drug crisis ever in the U.S. history, and arguably globally, as they have spread throughout Canada and are spreading in Mexico And it's only a matter of time when other regions of the world, like Europe and Asia, will also become hit by them. They are simply more lethal than any other drug. And in the United States, they are the most devastating drug. We are finding fentanyl use not simply mixed, in use with heroin, but today also with cocaine, with methamphetamine. Even though it's an absolutely devastating drug because of the lethality, the potency per weight, it's a drug that traffickers really like because it's so easy to smuggle because of how lightweight it is, how potent it is per weight. So a terrible problem.
I know smuggling of a drug like fentanyl is a moving target. What do we know about the most common way that fentanyl makes it into the United States?
So over the past 3 years, really, since 2019, 2020, when China legislated as a result of U.S. pressure, that the entire class of fentanyl-type drugs is what's called scheduled, can only be sold and exported and produced with special licenses, the trade follows the following path. China is the principal source of so-called precursor chemicals. They are the chemicals from which fentanyl is made. The second supplier is India, but China is the dominant one. These precursors are sold by Chinese traders and traffickers to Mexican criminal groups. They are imported to Mexico as precursor. And then the Mexican cartels, principally the Sinaloa cartel and cartel Jalisco Nueva Generacion, supervise their cooking, the chemical process by which the precursors are turned into finished fentanyl. And then they are, the Sinaloa cartel and cartel Jalisco Nueva Generacion are the principal wholesale suppliers to the U.S. A lot of the drugs, most of the drugs cross through legal ports of entry, hidden in cargo, in legal cargo, hidden in special compartments of cars. But they can also be flown across the border by drones, and they are also brought in by boats that land in California, for example. Now, some of the drugs come as fentanyl, as powder. Others are pressed into pills, often fake oxycodone pills, and are brought across the border in that form.
This is, it sounds like a much easier drug to make than, say, if you had to grow a crop, a poppy field to make a heroin. Is this process making it much easier to produce and then transport opioids?
Absolutely. And you get it exactly right. That is a synthetic drugs revolution sweeping the world. Synthetic drugs are much easier to produce. And that is also the case because one does not have to control territory. So if you are a supplier of cocaine or heroin, you need to control substantial territory on which to cultivate opium poppy or the coca plant from which then cocaine and heroin are produced. For synthetic drugs, small labs that are easily hidden in the cellar of a house can produce vast quantities that supply large areas, cities, even countries for a considerable amount of time. And this is especially true about synthetic opioids. So there are other synthetic drugs like methamphetamine that are potent and devastating. That's the drug of choice in East Asia and Asia Pacific, for example. In the United States, we have significant problem with methamphetamine that's also produced in Mexico. But synthetic opioids are so potent that so little amounts of them supply the entire market that they give tremendous advantage to traffickers. It requires very few labs to produce them, small labs. The chemistry is not particularly complex. And since the amounts of both precursor and the finished product are very limited, it's very easy to hide them in cargo. Now, by some estimates, it takes several trailer trucks full of cocaine and heroin to supply the U.S. market. And by several, I don't mean 100, but in the sort of single 10, 20 digits in the numbers, single or double digits. for fentanyl, we are really talking just a fraction of that. So very small amounts can supply the country, but also devastate lives. And consequently, hiding the cargo is very easy.
Talking to Vonda Fell, Bob Brown with the Brookings Institution, expert on the international drug trade there. You can join in our conversation about fentanyl, where it's coming from, how to stop it, where to stop it at the border, at its point of origin, in the demand side. Join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Vonda, I mentioned some members of Congress floating the idea of declaring the organizations that are producing and transporting these drugs in Mexico as terrorist organizations. You've written about this idea before. You have concerns, I think. Can you tell us what that would mean?
Yeah, so I fully appreciate why Senator Lindsey Graham and others are concerned about both the flow of fentanyl and its devastating effects. And frankly, the very inadequate state of cooperation from the Mexican government of Andrés Manuel López Obrador with U.S. law enforcement efforts. Clearly, the U.S. government needs to strongly demand far stronger action from the Mexican government that, since López Obrador came to power, really withdrew from the cooperation very substantially. And that, in my view, might also mean getting tough with Mexico. That said, I don't think that the terrorist designation is particularly useful. The Obama administration, the Trump administration, all considered that designation and decided not to do it. Currently, the trafficking groups are designed as transnational drug trafficking groups. That gives the U.S. government a wide panoply of tools to use, from interdiction arrests to financial sanctions and anti-money laundering measures, financial intelligence measures. The only additional tool that will become available with the terrorist designation is precisely the one that Senator Graham mentioned, which is the use of military force. Now, the Mexican government is fully opposed to the United States using military force in Mexico. And for the U.S. to do it, it would require essentially declaring a war on Mexico, a country that is enormously strategically important. It's our neighbor. It's our key trading partner. And our communities are deeply intertwined. So this is, you know, obviously enormously diplomatically poisonous and fraud. Second, the criminal groups, the cartels, are not like Al-Shabaab. They are not like ISIS. They don't exist in camp. They are not in the middle of a desert or in the middle of the forest like the leftist guerrillas in Colombia, the FARC, that are implicated in the production of cocaine. There are no obvious targets that a U.S. drone strikes, for example, would hit. And even if you can identify the target, its impact would be very limited. Much more robust interdiction efforts that seek to dismantle much of the operational layer of the cartel are far more useful. And finally, the terrorist designation comes with significant constraints on U.S. policy. The United States cannot engage in any way with any entity that provides material support to a terrorist group. That includes no financial, humanitarian, economic assistance. What would this mean in Mexico? For example, the cartel stacks legal commodities that are shipped to the United States: avocado, corn, grain, citrus, fish. If we designate the cartels as terrorist groups, we would probably have to face legal pressure not to be engaging in any of these imports because the cartels economically benefit from it. Or the United States could not provide any kind of alternative livelihoods assistance socioeconomic anti-crime assistance to the parts of Mexico where the cartels operate, which is all of Mexico, if the Mexican authorities could not assure guarantee that none of the economic aid would trickle to the cartels, which they cannot. So the situation in Mexico is very, very serious, and the administration of López Obrador has more or less abdicated for the past 4 years any kind of meaningful anti-crime policy. But the way to get out of that problem for us and for the Mexican people and Mexican government is not the designation.
We're talking to foreign policy expert Vonda Felbop-Brown from the Brookings Institution about the international drug trade and the flow of fentanyl in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where would you like to see efforts focused on stopping the flow of fentanyl? On the demand side, helping people avoid addictions maybe in the first place, more border security, more searches of those vehicles coming in at points of entry in Mexico itself. What questions do you have? What experiences have you had in your community, maybe your family, with the impact of fentanyl? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Vonda Felbop-Brown, Senior Fellow in the Strobe Talbot Center for Security, Strategy, and Technology in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, an expert on the international drug trade. With us today to look at how fentanyl and other synthetic opioid drugs flow in the United States, largely from Mexico. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. With your thoughts on this issue, maybe your experiences or your questions for our guest, join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hi. I think that, in my opinion, there should be a two-pronged approach. One, our government needs to step up the border inspection and our border patrols. But two, simultaneously, I think our government needs to try to incentivize pharmaceutical companies to develop some sort of a vaccine against fentanyl, its psycho effects on the brain, hallucinogenic effects, and incentivize them with a pretty sizable prize, a $1 billion prize for the first company that can develop some sort of a vaccine.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Let's take those one at a time, Vonda. First of all, more inspections at the border. You were talking about the challenges of finding fentanyl. A lot of vehicles cross from Mexico into the United States with legitimate trade and other purposes. Are there things you think we could do, though, Vonda, to make the border more secure when it comes to fentanyl coming in?
Well, we have several decades across multiple administration, both Republican and Democratic, that have made a lot of effort to strengthen the border, both on our side in modernization, putting in more inspection equipment, as well as on the Mexican side, or trying to induce the government of Mexico to do so. One of the controversial issues actually right now is the effort by the Mexican government to try to buy Chinese technology for the border inspections, where we have legitimate strong fears this could be used by the Chinese government for spying in the US. However, there is also recognition, obviously, that the border is not just a division line, it is also a membrane that needs to allow legal trade, which obviously is very substantial between our two countries and the legal movement of people. So how to strike the right balance between inspections and catching dangerous contraband such as fentanyl and allow trade is always difficult. And if we had good cooperation with the Mexican government, we could move a lot of that inspection into Mexico. That would be optimal policy. If we had good cooperation that would allow the US law enforcement agencies and officials to be present on fentanyl raids, to be part of interdiction of precursors, to be helping dismantle the Mexican drug trafficking groups. Unfortunately, the López Obrador administration in power in Mexico over the past 4 years withdrew all of that, essentially ended all of that cooperation. And so what we are stuck with now is border inspection. And I do believe there is appropriate time now to toughen border inspections, even if that means significantly slowing down the trade from Mexico to the US. This would be painful. It's economically not optimal, but the Mexican government has not shown that it is willing to cooperate meaningfully with other measures that would allow us to avoid this particular policy tool.
And our caller's other point had to do with the demand side of things. Now, I don't know how feasible it is to have a vaccine against the effects of fentanyl, but that said, are there things, Vonda, that you look at when it comes to the public's demand for drugs like fentanyl, where we could treat it there and reduce the incentive to bring this into the country in the first place?
Well, obviously, if we could figure out a way to prevent people from using drugs and developing substance use disorder, we would be in an optimal scenario. This is something that has been called for across many drugs for many decades, and the efforts are still not capable of preventing the devastating epidemic that we are seeing. However, although we don't have a vaccine, we have a very powerful drug, and that's naloxone, that has been crucial in preventing overdose and lethal overdose. So definitely pushing and promoting the availability of naloxone, making it very easy for people, doctors, ambulances, clinic users to access it, it's very important. And this is now becoming more widespread. Just several years ago, this was enormously controversial, with strong constituencies promoting much harsher approaches to dealing with drugs, strongly opposed to that, believing that allowing overdose reversing medications like naloxone would worsen the situation. There is some experimentation with places where users can inject and use safely. One of them is, for example, in New York. Those safe injection sites are part of a broader approach that's called harm reduction, still remains very controversial in the US, much more advanced and accepted in places like the Netherlands, Britain, Switzerland. I believe there is a strong role for the harm reduction approaches as well. But we are sadly in a situation where 6 years ago, users would be asking for heroin, and they would be unhappy if they were given fentanyl. Many of the established heroin opioid users that develop addiction either to heroin or first to pharmaceuticals and through them to transition to prescription drugs and heroin were not happy with the presence of fentanyl. This has now changed. Unfortunately, users are actively seeking fentanyl, despite the fact that it is so prevalent. And there are, of course, still very many unscrupulous dealers that are mixing fentanyl into, as I mentioned, also cocaine and methamphetamine. So we are nowhere close to solving the demand issue. There is no magic bullet for it. And while demand reduction and treatment measures need to be robustly funded, enabled, we need to be willing to experiment with, and more than experiment even, embrace policies such as methadone maintenance. It's not a silver bullet alone that's out there. Tackling supply side is also important.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Vonda, there's not one magic solution here, but we started off talking about Congress. If Congress could do one thing and get it signed by the president, what would you like to see the priority be?
On the demand side, it would certainly be expanding availability of treatment in many different forms, including making it possible for safe injection sites. And expanding methadone maintenance. On the supply side, I would like us to not move toward the foreign terrorist group designations, but to have robust legislative capabilities to slow down the border. And frankly, I think a lot of that could be done through executive action. But certainly, Congress plays a role in helping us get to a much sounder migration policy. currently, U.S. policy in Mexico is frequently held hostage to migration. This was the case during the Trump administration and continues to be the case during the Biden administration, that the Mexican government threatens larger flows of migrants, allowing more undocumented people from Central America to come. If we have a migration reform and legal access to jobs, we can be much tougher on the border with respect to fentanyl.
Thanks to our guest, Vonda Felbaugh-Brown with the Brookings Institution, joining us for a look at the flow of fentanyl and other drugs into the U.S. from Mexico. Coming up, an outdoor adventurer shares her winter trek across the Ice Age Trail in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.